Accession number 10232, reel number 1.
Mr. Crossland, reel 1. Could you tell me, Mr. Crossland, what job you were doing in Malaya when the emergency broke out?
Well, to start off with, I wasn't in Malaya at the start of the emergency. I came to Malaya after the emergency had broken out in November 1950. And as I'd had previous military experience and had been in the Indian Army and in Burma, which gave me some slight jungle experience, and the emergency in Malaya dealt to a large part with jungle, the first job that I was given was the assistant adjutant at the police depot, the training depot, where we had in all about 3,000 people under training in the way of police recruits and inspectorate. My task at the time really was to help to train these recruits who needed to know firstly the police regulations and police law, but at the same time, as we had an emergency on our hands, they were taught to use weapons, rifles and automatic weapons and pistols, because the big problem we had at the time was the Chinese communist emergency, of which there were, to my recollection, about 5,000 Chinese communists underground in the jungle at the time. And part of the recruits' training was to learn how to shoot and also learn how to move around in the jungle. Because at that time there was no military law, and never was there right throughout the whole of the emergency, which lasted nearly 10 years. It was a civil law that was being broken, and there was no martial law within the country. But we did have a number of British military regiments assisting, as we used to call it in those days, assisting the civil powers in maintaining law, because the emergency was an offence against law and order. It's putting it in a very simplified form, but strictly speaking, in the to the letter of the law, that's what it was. It was an offence against civil law, and no act was passed that enabled the military to have any major control in the country. And in fact, the police authorities had the largest amount of power in the country at the time during the emergency, and if they wanted some assistance, they would then call in the military.
Was there any frustration on the part of the police not having martial law, or were you satisfied with the laws as they existed?
No, I don't think there was any frustration. The frustration mostly was not being able to see your enemy, and also not being able to recognize him, because they were, as is currently in Northern Ireland, they were the same colour, shape and size as the general populace, except that they did wear uniforms, but they were capable of taking them off and dressing themselves just as any other person. If they were in uniform, then it was quite a simple matter. But we did have within the police two formations. One was the, or one could say three formations. One was the regular police, who maintained law and order amongst the general public. Another was the special branch, who did not wear uniform, which was a little futile in the case of Europeans, because a European could be detected in any case because of the colour of his skin. But he did not wear a uniform, but his job was to maintain or obtain information about the whereabouts of the communist terrorists who were causing us a lot of trouble. One of the main frustrations was that Malaya is so thickly populated with jungle and undergrowth, which grew right up to the edge of the roads, and a whole army of terrorists could conceal themselves on a bend, say, and did. And a popular word used almost every 5 minutes of the day was they used to ambush. And to be prepared for an ambush every second of a route that might take you 200, 300, or 400 miles is not that easy. And that was one of the most frustrating things. If you were ambushed, the chances of totally surviving were very small.
Did you go out in the jungle yourself after your period training the police recruits?
Yes, in fact, during the course of my, it was just less than 2 years I spent in the police depot, we used some of the recruits for cordoning purposes in kampong or village areas where they were being removed from one area to a safer area where they could be controlled. A number of particularly Chinese villagers, as the majority of the terrorists were Chinese, a number of them were giving assistance to the bandits, as they were once called, but when Gerald Templer came along, he had the name changed from bandits to communist terrorists. And when people were being forced, this the civil population, Chinese, were being forced to supply the underground terrorists with food and other supplies, if we could not control that supply, then it was decided by the civil authorities to move the villagers into an area, prepared area, where houses were prepared for them, water was laid on, but where they could be kept under eye, under watch. And on one occasion, two occasions I can recall, the recruits in the depot were asked or ordered to go out and help cordon areas so that people did not either escape or so that terrorists did not try and come in and disrupt the movement that government was trying to carry out.
You were with them on those cordons,
I was with them on those, yes.
Did people try to break through the cordons from your observation?
No, I don't think I recall any reports of anyone having broken through. One will never know if something had happened. It was always done very secretly, quietly, and without not much notice to the people who were being moved. Otherwise, they might have decided to move in another direction of their own accord.
How watertight do you think these cordons were?
Well, we were always very we're very cautious ourselves, and we tried to keep all of our policemen cautious and as security-minded as possible. But there were amongst the civil population, I'm sure, some genuine sympathizers with the communist terrorists. I mean, in other words, there were communist links, genuine believers too, I'm sure. Many of them who were not inside the jungle but held secret meetings, and part of the reason for those meetings was to assist those within the jungle. There were cells, as we called them, even inside these new villages to which we moved sympathizers, you know, to control them. In a number of cases, one of the most popular things to have done, of course, was to and this is no great secret, and it's common practice in intelligence services, and that is to break into the cell and get someone into it, so that at least you know. It is generally felt, and it's common practice, if you know there is a cell there, the best thing to do, rather than wipe it out so that it starts up elsewhere, is to get someone into it and keep a report on it, provided they're not doing intense damage. At least you know where it is and what it's doing. So, you know, it's better to have an eye on it rather than just kill it completely, and then by kill it I mean dispose of it, and then wonder where the next one's going to pop up.
Were you responsible for any of that kind of work?
Yes, after I left the depot, I went to the East Coast in Trengganu and became what is the smallest district command that they have in the police force. That is the overall command and the uniform branch, and that is the a police district, and they were then known as OCPDs. We used to use it almost as one word, OCPD. OCPD was an officer commanding a police district. And I had a district that stretched along the coast for about 40 miles and inland as far as you think you could go, because it was thick jungle and you just went as it would take you weeks to meet up with the next district going inland, and in any case you wouldn't, there are no demarcations or border lines in the jungle. But we had some terrorists in the area, but there wasn't as much activity there in the rural areas as there was around the edges of the cities and towns in Milan.
And in Trengganu you were able to put your own people in their cells, were you?
I wasn't at that time. Now that was to carry out that kind of operation was principally the function of the special branch, and I was at that time still in uniform branch. And my job mainly there, as any policeman's job, was to maintain law and order amongst the civil population. That, of course, required a greater amount of attention than the specifically chasing of terrorists.
So you went to Trengganu in 52, I gather.
52.
And you stayed for how long?
I stayed there for about a year. And one has to remember that one is at the mercy of your headquarters, who decide to move you to an area that is convenient for them rather than you. I liked the East Coast, and although we had an emergency on, one felt a form of conscience for the emergency, but there were some nice places to go to, and if you were fortunate enough to be in one of them, you just counted your blessings, and the East Coast was a very pleasant place to be in. It was right on the edge of the water, beautiful beaches, lovely seas, and the people were pleasant and friendly, as they are anywhere. It was a rural existence, and then after 1 year, I was then ordered, is the word, to go over to Kota Tinggi, which is just outside Johor.
Before we talk about that, could I ask you about Trengganu? Because was it an area which was particularly black?
No, it was a fairly peaceful area. They did have some terrorists there, but they were small in number, and not particularly vicious, as some of the others were in other parts of Malaysia. There were some notably bad areas. Johor was a bad area. Pahang was a bad area. Negeri Sembilan was a bad area. Pira, at one time, was extremely bad.
Why do you think Terengganu was not a bad area?
I think because it was more sparsely populated, and principally above that, there weren't many Chinese there, and the Chinese needed the support from the public, and they needed Chinese support. The average Malay knew that the end result of the Chinese underground communist movement, if they won, would be that they would be subjugated by the Chinese. And there always had been a little feeling of enmity between the Malays and the Chinese, although they are endeavouring to live as happily together as possible now. But it always has been there, possibly because the Malays are a very pleasant, easygoing race. The Chinese are industrious, and they are the commercial ones of the country. And I think Malays like to feel that the country itself is theirs, and the business should not be taken from them by the Chinese. But the Chinese are more industrious than the Malays anyway.
Are there any incidents which stick out in your mind from your period at Terengganu which you can relate in detail?
Not so much, really. I mean, only one that would refer to in any particular item that referred to the emergency, which is what we're particularly concerned with. No, I can remember a crocodile, a very large crocodile, creeping up a drain and into the main street of Kamarman, which is where I was in charge, and being called down to dispose of it. The crocodiles were not particularly liked, as a lot of them did dispose of villagers around the area. I recall also another item of amusement rather than just an horrific item. We had a circus that, you believe it or not, during the emergency, life still went on, and there were circuses with people from places like Korea and Chinese jugglers and acrobats, and the whole circus moved around on heavy vehicles. We had a road, a very dusty road, and we had five ferries we had to cross before we could get to our headquarters. It should take us all day to drive 104 miles. But the circus passed through. But they didn't have any vehicles strong enough to take elephants. And the elephants had to go on foot and just plodded along. And I did have one of my inspectors who came to me one day and said, "Sir, we have some trouble in the next village, a place called Kemasek." And I said, "And what is the trouble?" And he said, "An elephant has died in the road." And I drove to the site, and there was a huge dead elephant in the middle of the road. The road is quite narrow, and it meant really that one had to go round into the bits of the jungle to circumnavigate this elephant. And having just come from the police depot, they thought that I should have the answer to everything, and I looked through all my books and I couldn't find anything about dead elephants in them at all. I knew everything else I thought about the law, but not how to dispose of dead elephants. And the answer was provided for me by the appearance of a Home Guard commander who was a local Malay. We used to have a Home Guard then. And I said, "How many Home Guards do you have?" And he said, "I've got 30 men I can call on." And I said, "Well, now, why don't we tie some ropes around the legs of this elephant, dig a big hole on the side of the road, and drop the elephant into it, and then pile earth on top of it," which we eventually did. That's the way, one of the first big jobs I had on joining my district. And forever afterwards, and this is a common thing in Malaya, they will refer to an incident or circumstances, and that place was always known as Little Elephant Hill.
You were telling me earlier that there were three subdivisions of the police, the ordinary police, the special branch, but I don't think
and
you said
that was the third one were the jungle companies. They were provided by the police, and that those people actually spent most of their time, all of their time, in the jungle chasing after, but they were actual policemen. So don't forget, the army did not have normal powers of arrest, but a jungle company policeman did, and he was within the law. I don't think we had. I think if an army soldier should need to hold somebody on a suspicion of some felony, I think that a policeman would pretty soon come to his rescue and relieve him of this person. But I suppose if they weren't that sophisticated, that they would have taken a soldier to court for wrongful arrest.
Now, you said that in 1953, I think it was, you were moved to Kota Tinggi. Mm. What was the situation there regarding the emergency in comparison with Trengganu?
That was quite horrific there. I mean, there were incidents almost every day. Kota Tinggi, as it was near Johor, which is near Singapore, was a popular area for rubber planting. There was quite a lot of rubber planting and tin mining in and around the area. Now, rubber planting obviously has to be done outside of a town. You don't plant rubber in the middle of a town, and it's in a rural area where it is so easy to contact the workers who are working in the planting areas or in the tin mining areas. We did our utmost to put in special constables, which we had. There's another, a fourth division, if you like, special constables who were not regular policemen, and they were on a monthly basis, and they weren't normally pensionable. We used to get special constables to go out to the tin mines and protect the dredges and go out to the rubber plantations and protect the rubber planters and their families and their houses. Kota Tinggi was 26 miles from Johor town, and the road was no different from the other roads in central Malaya. It was thick jungle right up to the edge of the road. And it also was, it contained two or three favourite crossing places where the different units of terrorists would cross. It was known through interrogation of captured terrorists that they would cross from one point to another in order to get from one area to another. They had their own couriers and their own messengers, and they would choose an area which was unlikely to be inhabited by police or by even other rubber planters or any form of civilization, and was quiet. But if you happened to bump into them as they were crossing, then you would find that either they would wait, if they didn't want to be noticed, they would wait until you've gone. But if you were on your own and there were half a dozen of them, then that was just hard luck on you.
Any incidents here in Kota Tinggi that you can relate which stick out in your mind?
Yeah, there were a number of ambushes with people killed. We had a number of a lot of the army working in the jungle nearby at Kota Tinggi. I was there as an OCPD again. Yes, the what items did I remember of
any ambushes that you were involved in?
I was never actually involved in an ambush. although later I'll tell you of some active work that one did, but then it was at a later time when I transferred to a special branch, and then my work was closely associated with, in fact almost entirely, with terrorism, whereas your work as a uniformed policeman had to mostly concentrate upon the keeping of the normal peace, and with every aspect of law that occurs even in this country, you know, illegal trading or affrays or murders. In fact, I had 3 murders at different times that I had to cope with as an OCPD. On another occasion, I can recall an incident where a Buddhist priest in the temple had lured two little girls into the temple. He was later found to be deranged, and the mothers, looking for them, knowing that they had gone in there, went to him. They saw some smoke coming out, and he was attempting to burn the bodies, and eventually one of my inspectors went to investigate, and he was sliced through the shoulder with an axe by this deranged Buddhist priest. And I was away, it was a Sunday, and I was having a little rest, and then another inspector called me from the house of another police officer, where whenever we went anywhere we had to leave a telephone number 24 hours a day for the whole of the 10 years or more of the emergency. And I shot back and found the whole of the town was in a ring around this temple, and this man had locked himself inside and wouldn't come out. But by good fortune, knowing he got an axe, I armed myself with a long pick helve, and so that I could at least keep him at pick helve's length and arm length as well. And when I got there, I found the door closed, and the fire brigade was already also out there, and one of them slid across the floor, this big open space which is part of the praying area in the temple, slid an axe over. So I axed through the lock area, and the Almighty was good to me, because the man by then I think had realized what the results were, and he was quite submissive, and he came out freely.
How long were you at Kota Tinggi?
I was at Kota Tinggi for just under 2 years.
Until about 1955?
Yes, I went on 2 years, hold on, wait, 54, so it would have been, because it was 4 years, and 4.5 years, about a year and a half in Kota Tinggi.
Was it then that you went into special branch work after that?
No, I went on leave then for 6 months, and the usual procedure was that if you came back by sea, and that was the common form of transport in the early days,